I'm Charlie Mays. I'm not the village philosopher. I'm closer to the village idiot. But Chuck Mayer is out on a hike, and so he asked me to fill in tonight for him. And I thought that for our subject tonight, we would choose something that grows out of some things that Judy Madison has already been doing in the village this week already, and that tomorrow, this will serve then as some kind of perhaps a discussion or response to some of the things that Judy has shared, like even the choral reading last night, if you haven't been to her sessions. The other thing will be a kind of an introduction to some things that Ted Peters will begin doing tomorrow when he begins a study of the book of Revelation and gets into some ways that he'll introduce some thinking about the future to us. So what I thought I would do tonight is to share a few words from the theme book for this year, one of the two theme books, which is the Global 2000 Report to the President, a study commissioned by Jimmy Carter on the 23rd of May in 1977, surfaced briefly during the 1980 presidential campaign. Carter made a remark about it may be that we will have to learn all of us to live with less. That was not very politically popular, and so they forgot that theme. And also in the reading that we did last night, you may have noticed that Judy had a quote from the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, who I suppose at that time was it Volcker already? That it looked, you know, that we were going to have to, from his judgment, even learn to live with less. So anyway, let me just read a few things from this. And then what I invite you to do is simply to share wherever that takes you. The purpose of a forum is not for people to lecture to you. It isn't even necessarily for us to be factual about what we talk about. The most important thing is for us to get some arena at the village where we can say something, or where you as villagers can say something, instead of just those of us who are in teaching staff droning on and on, giving you the hold in line or whatever it might be. And so it's your chance to speak up, and I will try not to do anything more than to say you speak and you and so on. And the other ground rule is you don't have to respond to the person before you. If you want to come off the left field wall with something, that's perfectly all right. It doesn't have to respond. And that way it gives you the freedom to get your opinion stated or your facts before the folks. In the section, the introduction to the section of the Global 2000 Report, Major Findings and Conclusions, we read these paragraphs. If present trends continue, the world in 2000 will be more crowded, more polluted, less stable ecologically, and more vulnerable to disruption than the world we live in now. Serious stresses involving population, resources, and environment are clearly visible ahead. Despite greater material output, the world's people will be poorer in many ways than they are today. For hundreds of millions of the desperately poor, the outlook for food and other necessities of life will be no better. For many, it will be worse. Barring revolutionary advances in technology, life for most people on Earth will be more precarious in 2000 than it is now, unless the nations of the world act decisively to alter current trends. This, in essence, is the picture emerging from the U.S. government's projections of probable changes in world population, resources, and environment by the end of the century, as presented in the Global 2000 study. They do not predict what will occur. Rather, they depict conditions that are likely to develop if there are no changes in public policies, institutions, or rates of technological advance, and if there are no wars or other major disruptions. A keener awareness of the nature of the current trends, however, may induce changes that will alter these trends and the projected outcome. Now they say, entering the 21st century. And I'll just read the first sentence of each of these paragraphs. The world in 2000 will be different from the world today in many important ways. There will be more people. The gap between the richest and the poorest will have increased. There will be fewer resources to go around. The environment will have lost important life-supporting capabilities. Prices will be higher. The world will be more vulnerable both to natural disaster and to disruption from human causes. Finally, it must be emphasized that if public policies continue generally unchanged, the world will be different as a result of lost opportunities. The adverse effects of many of the trends discussed in this study will not be fully evident until 2000 or later, yet the actions that are necessary to change the trends cannot be postponed without foreclosing important options. That's the good news. I think that's a fairly fair representation of the, you know, of the conclusions of that. And our question tonight is, will life be better in the year 2000? And I assume by putting that up, better than it is now. So with that, I'm going to open it up and let you talk wherever you want. Do we disagree with that? One of the things that there's room for is disagreement. A lot of experts have disagreed with some of the data that was used in this report. So if you feel that you want to take off on some of that, fine. If something else.
The problem is with the word better, what that means.
All right. Okay, how would you define that and answer that then, Lyle? Okay.
I think an issue that this brings up for me is when we talk about better, am I talking about me or am I talking about the world? There's a tendency for we as Americans to think that we can take care of us and turn our backs on the undeveloped countries. And one of the things that bothered me for an issue that came up today in Lowell Erding's talk was the issue of justice. And when we look at justice, it's difficult to maintain that kind of a perspective that we protect our own interests and do not take into account, you know, what's happening elsewhere.
Okay. Any other? Paul?
I have some problem with the data of the report when you take a period of time and then just extend it into the year 2000. I suspect that what's happened, at least in this country, in the last 2 or 3 years in energy usage, at least electricity, because of electrical rates on all of our plants, it's an issue of some importance, and everyone's talking about how they're cutting back and they're aware of their consumption and the cost of those electrical bills. And I suspect that a lot of the economic conditions of today, 1981, have changed some of the trends probably remarkably. Automobile sales are way off, and if that was one of the inputs in terms of usage of a non-renewable resource, steel and all the other minerals are going down. I suspect there's been a reasonable change since the study was begun, what, 1977, 78? So I suspect there's been a change already that's taking place because of the economic situation. Although I'm not bold enough to say that things aren't still going to be different by 1980. But I think maybe the study might be painting the picture a little bit worse than maybe the most likely case.
They claim when you hook it up with all the other world studies that's been done, it's 15 to 20% too optimistic.
Who is they?
The study. People who did the study. It's neither here nor there, but the man that edited it is ALC Lehman, or whatever that's worth. It's got to have credibility, right? Okay, anyone else? So that is a question, that is a concern. They even raise it. Will looking at these projections alter the, you know, they're not predictions, they're projections. It's a very clear something you want to have in your mind, okay? Anything, any other response? Ted, you look like you're ready.
I was going to say, the function of such projections in all futurist thought is not really to forecast or not really to predict the future anyway, but it's supposed to influence what we do in the present. So that if all these present trends did in fact continue for 20 years, they would be just as surprised as we would be. Because the factor that comes in between are the decisions that we make in order to take control of whatever future it is that we have. So that it's not at all unusual for a forecast such as you find in this report to be 3 or 4 years later out of date, and nobody cries over that. In fact, the pessimists are just hoping for the kind of thing that you're talking about. Gee whiz, if we raise the consciousness about depleted sources of energy and people start conserving and cutting back, well, then we've done our job rather well. And the same with population control is even more dramatic than conserving energy, because with the population bomb and all of the other kinds of media presentation of the population problem, which occurred some 10 years ago, there has in fact been rather dramatic cutbacks in population growth, even in some of the third world countries. Not enough to forestall disaster, but at least enough to show that that decisions can influence trends, at least modestly.
Okay.
Since I've been here, there have been a number of conversations along this line, and always we seem to somehow get caught. I remember a gentleman a couple days ago sitting over here saying, but if we cut back, will that help third world poor? And when we start arguing effectiveness and statistics, I think that's an easy way to get around the issue. And the issue seems to me one of justice. We've cut back because of electricity for economic reasons, basically. And maybe that's the thing that motivates Americans, is to make a few or save a few dollars. But somehow it seems to be a fundamental question of justice. Do I have a right, just because I can afford it, to consume, you know, all that money can buy? Or do I have an obligation for my sister and brother in need? And when I'm in my home congregation, it's the same sort of thing. They'll make adjustments for economic reasons, or they'll say quitting, not eating a McDonald's will not affect world hunger. It never seems to be honing in on that theological question. Just because I have the power and just because I have the dollars, do I have the moral right to continue to consume whatever money buys? And that's what makes me think that the year 2000 is going to be awfully grim.
Because you're saying people won't deal with the justice issue, is your...
Don't want to. In fact, again, in the home parish, it creates hostility. You know, because they worked for that money. And they deserve to spend it however they want, they say. And it's not a theological issue. It is an economic issue. It is a statistical issue.
I wondered if you had studied much economics.
For what reason?
Well, your ideals are great, and the idea of justice, but the tire hits the pavement, it really is going to largely be economics and politics.
You push a button, and when you do that, because that is exactly the problem we have as a country, is saying everything is determined by the marketplace, by supply and demand, and now this trickle-down nonsense. And it is not the way I understand a Christian to make decisions.
This isn't a Christian world.
But I am, you know, and I have to be determined. If, have to take a breath there. if I thought that I was totally determined by supply and demand, I'd shoot myself. Because in that, there is no hope for me. But if I decide to live, whether it makes sense to anyone else or not, with a vision of what shalom is and what my obligation to my sisters and brothers are, I can continue to live, even though the forecasts are rather bleak and the future seems to me to be rather hopeless.
Okay, so the question gets to be, what happens when a faith perspective runs up against economic and political realities? All right? Okay, Ted?
I'd like to sort through that and ask a question of clarification. What makes your and my decision to consume more or consume less moral or theological? And you suggested that it had to do with justice. And hence the question that occurred in John Tram's discussion of a couple of days ago, how do we know if and to what extent the kinds of actions we take in conserving our own consumption really will reap a benefit for somebody else? And John passed that question off to the group, and of course eventually there was no answer, and I suspect that a lot of people don't know the answer. So I would pose the question to you this way. Suppose it could be proved that if you and I stopped eating McDonald's hamburgers, that this yielded no direct benefit to poor people in another country, would it still be a moral and a theological issue in your mind for you and I to, and I thought you said it very well, just because we got the dollars doesn't mean we have the right to go out and consume everything we can buy. What is it that makes it a theological or moral issue? If it's justice, then the burden of proof would be on your shoulders to show exactly how it is that your and my action has a direct benefit or disbenefit to somebody else. But could it be a matter of the human soul, regardless of what kind of effect it would have?
I don't know if the benefit is the issue. You know, maybe it doesn't benefit. I don't know if that's the issue.
I think that's the question you're raising, isn't it, Ted?
Yeah, and it's an open question. I don't have a hidden agenda. What makes it a moral and a theological issue?
Okay.
Especially when it's in doubt as to how we can affect it.
All right.
Well, I think our capitalist society puts us on the horns of a dilemma. In order for our Christian brothers to keep their jobs, we have to consume the products that they produce. If we all quit going to McDonald's, then people are going to be out of jobs at McDonald's. And that's
our kids.
Yeah, our kids.
could we switch it to coffee? That, I think, is more realistic than McDonald's.
Everything. Is somebody who makes coffee, they're not important?
Okay.
Yeah, there's nothing really about coffee. That's an interesting point. It said that, I think it was said, maybe correct me if I'm wrong on this, that a lot of the land in Brazil, places like that, have been converted to coffee because it's higher profitable crop than growing vegetables to feed their families. My question is, if I stop making coffee, what will happen down there? Will they simply be laid off and be starving even more without any income at all?
Charlie, you
our bigger question is that land won't grow crops.
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. You know, I mean, if it would help a lot, I would be willing to do it. But I think what's going to happen is that we're, like Chris says, we're on horns of dilemma here. In another respect, is that we're trying to influence another country, how they are set up politically and so on. And it's not going to work, you know. I mean,
well, that's
the,
what
the, the problem down there is the big landowners controlling all the economy. They're very rich and they're very poor down there. And unless we want to have another crusade like we did in Vietnam for a different purpose now, how are we going to do anything about it? I just can't see stopping drinking coffee, which may be all right. I don't care. I coffee that much anyway. It doesn't do that much good.
Okay. Any other responses? Or? The issue of food, I think, you know, I'm going to try to stay out of this pretty much, but I think in terms of finding, you know, part of what we need to do is to know something, I guess, and and of course, the more you know, the more complex this whole issue gets. You know, like the food production, and there are some places where coffee is, in fact, you know, something that can be raised in otherwise non-arable land. But one of the things that came as a shock to me when I got into this study is that the United States is a basic importer, net importer of food, not an exporter. That we import more foodstuffs than we export. Pineapples, bananas, coffee, sugar, those kinds of non-essential crops. And part of our difficulty gets to be like in the Philippines, where Dole Pineapple went in and bought thousands of acres of land formerly farmed by tenant farmers. They do pay higher wages than the tenant farmers ever got, but it's to less than 10% of the farmers who are left on the land. The other 90% go to the cities. So there's an immense, complex web in which, you know, there's a lot of connections. I think I would suggest like a book that called Food First. I think it takes care of a lot of the concepts we have about food and its production. Also, just to raise the question about the year 2000, people who have done much study of the matter claim that, like in Iowa, they lose 2 bushels of topsoil for every bushel of corn that's produced. And farming methods in this country are not compatible with long-term farming.
I'd really like to look at that statistic when you said it, because by all the years I've been growing corn there, there wouldn't be anything left.
No, that's... The thing is, they're moving, you know, this has been, I questioned that when I first heard that too. Leo Bustead was the first person I heard it from, who's the head of the veterinary school at the University of, at the Washington State University. And when Rudy Edmond was here, we looked into that, and that is fairly substantiated.
For how long?
Yeah.
Why?
May I say
sure.
Something to that situation? Statistics like this are, you know, it takes a while to develop these statistics. In the meantime, the agricultural community is aware of some of these problems and are making efforts to correct some of them. And this is specifically one of the things that is being approached now. And there are techniques that are becoming operational on the large farms in the Midwest, and this is where these studies primarily come from. There are techniques, agronomic techniques, that is minimizing this erosion and eliminating it in some areas. So, you know, that's one of the things that I questioned in the report. Specific thing about this high rate of erosion. This has been going on for a long time, but the techniques are changing, and hopefully the problem will be alleviated or corrected.
But are not those techniques employed simply by the farmers with conscience regarding the future of the land, or are they? Is it an overall industrial pattern that's changing?
No, they're techniques which will be generally adopted because
not
the bottom
the
line, because they will be more profitable when the technique gets worked out. It's a matter of economics, and I think regardless of how we relate to it, economics is the driving force in many of the decisions that are made in the way we our economy is run.
And
it
caused things. Yeah,
low. I've been off the farm a long time, and so I don't know too much about all these things, but as we drove out here 3 weeks ago, we listened to a program for an hour on the radio as we came across eastern Washington, and they interviewed a lot of farmers on that program. We were driving right through that, what looked like a beautiful wheat country and so on, and these farmers were people of conscience who were themselves tremendously disturbed about the fact that though they knew the things they ought to do, to preserve that land. They said that land is going down year after year after year in the way they're farming it. That they say, we cannot economically do the things that we know are best for that land because we've got to pay our interest, we've got to pay our mortgage, we've got to pay all these things. And I know a relative down in southern Minnesota who says he's got to get $3 a bushel for corn. He's going to break even, and the corn isn't $2.50. I don't know what it is. And that a lot of these things, they say the only way we can keep from, you know, keep the banker from the door, so to speak, is that we cannot put those things into practice. Now, I don't know how widespread that is, but it was really a poignant thing to hear that program and to talk with his relative.
Okay, anyone else?
Just in response to Ted, I've been trying to figure out something practical. Okay. The members of the ALC give about 2.7% of their money away. And money is really just a shorthand for power. Because we have made some decisions about our lifestyle, we're able to give between 13 and 14% away and continue to try to bump that up. And I think that is, in a very real way, working to get rid of some of the power we have to give that not only to the church, but also to like the ALC Hunger Appeal and all. So I think there is a way, personally, of making a modest contribution.
Okay. All right. Anyone want to go? We're dealing about futures, and all of this has to do with how what we perceive to be present realities does have a great impact, obviously, on what the future.
Just one question of clarification. You shocked me, my dear, talking about us being a net importer of food. I've always heard, for years and years and years, that we were the chief exporters of food in the world, ourselves, Canada, Australia, and
New Zealand?
Yeah, those are the four countries that are exporters of food.
Yeah, we...
Now, what was that basis? This is new to me.
Yeah, the food first people in their studies, you know, show in terms of the kinds of crops that we import and then what we export. And I suppose that translates down into dollars. And on that basis, we actually are a net importer.
Are they getting Hawaii and Alaska as part of the United States?
Sure.
Or do they count those as imports?
No, they would count them as part of the United States.
Who has food first?
It's a group out of San Francisco, and I can't think of the institute for whatever it is, but they have fairly decent credentials. And the thing, I realized too, that one always has to be very cautious about studies. Time magazine, in October 26th issue, I think it was, had a thing on arming the world, which shows that since 1975 we have been the major armors of the world. And the administration just yesterday released a report that shows in the last 10 years we're second. But yeah, I think, one wants to watch that database.
I think part of the statistic on the net importing has to deal with the fact that we tend to think we are the major exporter of things like wheat and grain products and that, but the importing crops that we bring in are relatively more expensive, yeah. So that, say per bushel of coffee related to a bushel of wheat, coffee costs more, so that's where the money figure comes in. The volume level of it is we put more out. The group you're talking about, San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken, the basic author of Diet for Small Planet.
That's right. Frappe or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Very expensive, the works. And I think that's a valid statistic, but it has to be interpreted. Total volume-wise, we probably put more out than we bring in, but what we bring in are the more esoteric, expensive, and
luxury food.
Luxury food.
It doesn't help support the rest of the world. I think it does the landed money people. That's, I think the fallacy is, when 14% of the people in Guatemala or in El Salvador own 90% of the land, and they are making the money on the cash products that are exported from that country, that does not, I don't think that helps the world. And I agree that economics run is the engine that runs the world. I think the question Joe is asking is whether, as Christians, we can think of an economic system that produces a more just world.
How do you propose to change that?
Well, the first thing I'm proposing is that we see what's going on. I think that's, I believe that's a major concern, of, at least of mine. And that I don't think there's justice going on. I said it wasn't interesting. The justice is going on when the richest fourth of the world, including ourselves and the industrialized nations of the north, of the northern hemisphere, consume 3/4 of everything. If I were God and I had 10 children and I started to pass the plate, and the first 2.5 of them got 7.5, you know, got 75% of the stuff, and the end of the table got little or nothing, I just wonder how long that would continue if I were a loving parent of all of these children.
That raises another issue, and I think it may be that one of the issues that we all deal with is our guilt around that issue. At least, it's difficult to hear that, to be concerned with that, without getting in touch with guilt, you know, which in a way puts us in a dilemma, because I don't think we feel like it's hard to take responsibility for supporting that, you know, happening when we're born into this culture and into our own situation.
But you know, it's so frustrating when some of the futile and probably ill-fated attempts to help some of the third world countries, the country will not permit you to say, go in and pass out wheat. You have to give it to the political leaders, and then it ends up you just create more rich hierarchy,
right,
because they're
right,
the ones who are going to make money off of what we gave out of all good charity. And so it really is tremendous.
It's
and how do you go about this great idea of sharing?
Okay. I agree with that. So what? Let's talk about some of that. And don't push my buttons. I'm supposed to do it. You can see why I'm the village idiot and not the village philosopher. Right? I don't have a fact in my head, but boy, have I got opinions. Wow. All right. Back here.
Some of these problems have other options. You know, we could, if we were creative, we could think of other ways of handling it. To say, how to distribute wheat through the powers. I lived in Canada for quite a few years, and up there, Lutheran World Relief donations are matched by both the federal and the provincial government. So I give $10 to Lutheran World Relief, $30 goes overseas, instead of the government sending that over to, you know, with political strings attached. So I think that that's, you know, one of the possibilities, to let some of the church and other relief agencies that aren't making a lot of profit to be distributors of some of it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Isn't part of the difficulty always that the way we work things, fulfilling human need and making people happy is a potential byproduct of economics. And sometimes it happens. Obviously, that good byproduct does occur, but it isn't the driving force. Profit is the driving force. Because that's the driving force, there's always the other potential too that seems to supersede and dissipate the potential of good that we want to happen. But those things are only byproducts, because power is there, and power follows money. And in a sinful world where power follows money, that byproduct of good is not always going to happen. And that's the frustration.
An economist would probably argue that the good is what economics is about. I mean, that's a pure economist, I think, would argue that the seeking of profit is the seeking of to maximize the good. The question is who it's for. And, of course, the capitalistic system is predicated, as I understand Adam Smith's argument, was that the mechanisms would maximize the good for all. Of course, I don't think Adam Smith had in mind corporate capitalism. I think it's a different animal. And we haven't necessarily adjusted some economic thinking that fits the change in the structure of capitalism. It's a very different structure, I think, than Adam Smith visualized. Ted?
I think another difference between Smith and our own time is that Smith believed in divine providence, and that actually capitalism isn't a system, it's a non-system.
Right, it's a breaking
and,
down system.
And this capitalistic non-system could be trusted because divine providence would see to it that the absolute wealth of everyone would increase. Today, we don't believe in divine providence. I mean, maybe Christians do, but certainly the world doesn't, and the capitalists don't. And we see economics as being really natural forces or human forces or social forces strictly without the divine hand working within the matrix. So we just have one brute economic power set up over against another brute economic power, and that's all there is. And to me, I see that as a major shift. In the way we think economically. I don't know what the ultimate impact of that is going to be, but I think one impact is that it makes us believe that economics is far more awesome than previously we thought.
Way in the back.
I think we have one other difficulty, and perhaps even more fundamental, in a sense, to our own perception of the world, our own human nature, and that is that every one of us in this room, and probably the parents of every one of us in this room, has grown up under a structure of thought and of the world which compartmentalizes reality. We study it in schools by sections. We look at all of everything in reality as sections. We have times when we work and times when we relax and times when we worship. And it's a very pervasive way of looking at the world. And it's just a matter of fact we have to deal with. The difficulty for that is that is not the kind of worldview that is scriptural or Christian, because that was at a time that looked at the world in a much more broad sense, so that a person didn't go to work and go to church and go to recreation as a different person, so to speak, or you didn't go to work outside of the context of you going to worship or going to recreation. All these things took place in one huge whole or harmony. The difficulty then arises for us is that we say, okay, here I am as an economic person, an economic animal here, and I have to work in the capitalist system, and over here I'm a Christian person and I work in that system, and somehow or other they're not too well connected, or I have no power as a Christian person to influence the economic world that I have to live in. I think there is a need for us out of the Judeo-Christian tradition as Christians to really try to break down some of those walls and see how we as a worshiping child of God also have to influence, live, perceive, and be a part of some of these other systems. And not just say, well, you know, that's the way the business world works and I just, you know, nothing more I can do about it. And that's a very fundamental and difficult thing for us to struggle with in 1982.
And so a different way of perceiving even is suggested.
And different way of acting out. Not just perceiving, but different way of acting out. The way of who we are, our identity as a human being.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes left, and it occurs to me that I'd like to do something. I don't know if it can be done. I'd like to have people that haven't had a chance to say anything. Maybe they feel like, you know, I'll bomb them or something. That's the way my people, my congregation feel. And my wife alerted me a long time ago that the only, you know, that I ought to quit doing that, and I figured out I couldn't. So I told them, well, when they say something, then I bomb them, then they come back and want to say, well, we still don't agree or we still don't understand, and then maybe we can talk. So I'd like to invite people who just came with some thought about the question, will life be better in the year 2000, who may not feel that you're the most articulate person here. I've demonstrated that you're not the least. If you just feel like you'd like to address that question, if you haven't spoken yet or want to say something, because I do want this to be a time for you to just say, boom.
Concerning the world changing by the year 2000, in school for class, I read a book called Entropy by Jeremy Rifkin, which deals with the second law of thermodynamics that states everything is going from a state of chaos, no, from a state of order to disorder. And he brought about many examples of how our world is leading that way, and how, I forget his projected year, but we're going to have to learn how to live with that idea and that kind of change. And it's can be scary, but it can be exciting too, in the fact that if we're dealing with something so new like that, well then, you know, there will be new pioneers to go with it. That makes sense?
Okay. All right.
So it's like, and I had a teacher. My teacher was, for the science class that we dealt with, he taught in this manner of entropy, and his ways of thinking were involved around this, and it can really make a lot of sense in trying to deal with some of these, you know, loss of fuel, and we're just going to have to change, I guess, is what it boils down to.
Okay, thank you, David. Anyone else that had?
That relates to one of the thoughts I have, well, I've had over the last couple of days, and Bob and I actually talked about in the past, and in terms of the moral responsibility of being a parent right now. And I keep wondering if we've done our children a huge disservice by not teaching them to live with less. I realize that they're probably more adaptable than a lot of kids I know, and yet they've also had plenty, and it scares me when I think about the year 2000 and how they may have to adjust without ever really having been prepared adequately for that. They may adjust better than we will.
I graduated from high school in June, and it was incredible, the fear that was underlying our graduation. The whole senior class had such a negative attitude about the future, and I'm really scared that I'm not going to be able to get enough money to get through college and not be able to find a job after I get out of college. And I think the most thing I'm scared of is that I really want to have children, but I don't feel like I can bring somebody into the world to have to face what I have a feeling we're going to have to face in 2000. And I would just be so guilty. I really don't know what I'd do about it.
Okay, thank you for that very... You know, I think one of the things that this is something, you know, that Jonathan Schell in The Fate of the Earth asked the question, what does it mean to be a high school graduate who lives in that situation, and what does that mean for planning? And that's a different world than I graduated into, right? And so, you know, I don't want to leave us with no hope, but that's not the agenda tonight either. But I do think it gets back to even the Vesper service tonight. What is hope? Where does it divide off from wishing and despairing? Okay, I'm not going to say any more than that. But thank you for that, Richard.
There's a book that's in the bookstore and library too that one of you read very coming here. And it's appropriate for Golden Village. It's called The Towns of God by Morris West. Same author wrote The Shoes of the Fisherman. It's an extremely, it's a novel, so it's not real. Layer of fears on that, because it gets very fearful at some points. But it's a unique book because it's extremely theological, and it starts to address some of the things that this community addresses in terms of its lifestyle, its style of going about community meetings, discussions, and forums. But yet, in a way, it also has some visions about our future. I'm not sure what Morris West is or how God is moving in him. Because The Shoes of the Fisherman talks about a Polish pope. We have one now. The irony is, this book talks about the pope that follows the one we have now.
What's the name of this book?
Clowns of God.
A Vision of the Parousia.
We're going to sell books. Ted has written two books on the future, at least two that I know of.
Faith, Fear, and the Future. Is that correct? I can never get all the F's together. And then Futures, Human and Divine, both of which I think are helpful.
The report you were quoting or reading from said that unless we had some revolutionary developments in technology, we could expect these things. I have no idea what result would develop if fusion, for instance, were accomplished in the next 20 years. It would certainly change the economics of the energy situation. It seems to have the recent developments in the energy world has changed the economics of the and our attitudes toward the third world, our friends and enemies in the world. Does that report, or does anyone here have any thoughts on some revolutionary idea? You know, I don't think that we can look to science for magic, but it is a possibility.
It seems like wishing.
He is the captain. It's been, I'll give you a confession about my own nature. I'm an utter optimist. I grew up in a family where my father's slogan was, well, that's no problem, you know, we can handle that. And I am innately an optimist. And so I have to struggle with where does my optimism end and my Christian hope begin. You know, the one thing I've come to learn, I think, or see, perceive, is that for all the blessings of technology, it carries with it a dark side. I remember when I was a youngster and DDT first came out, and that was the end of the bugs. You know, now mother's milk has suspicious levels of it. And so there's always, I talked to a fellow fact who's going to be up here and do some work on energy in this next month from PLU, John Herzog. He says the only problem with fusion is that it, you know, I don't know what the temperatures are, but they're enormous. And the way that you keep that material suspended is between a magnetic force, which takes near the temperature of absolute zero. So if they can just figure that out, how to have this temperature of the sun in an atmosphere near 0 degrees, you've got it made. I mean, there are problems with it, John is saying. But that's not to say, I mean, I don't want to sell short, nor do I think we should in our hoping, human ingenuity. But to make a god of it has been, you know, Douglas John Hall, Light in Our Darkness, says our difficulty is that human beings are neither good enough nor wise enough to be master.
I'm not suggesting that if fusion were a reality in 1990 or something like this, that would change the governments of these other countries or of ours, the way in which we use and misuse the resources of the world.
All right, anybody want to have the last remarks, Judy?
No, I don't want to have the last remarks.
Well, we'll give one more then. And it won't be mine, I promise.
Two words stuck in my mind. One was guilt. I don't think that's particularly unhealthy. Kind of depends on what you do with it. Guilt is the beginning, I suppose, of repentance, and sometimes we can turn around and go a different way. The other word is power, and sometimes when we get into talking about economics and other world governments,
even our own government, we take a posture of powerlessness. And we get kind of used to that, and that's despair, in a sense. That's saying, I can't do anything about it. Resignation. And I think we have power over our own lives. We have power over our own decisions. And maybe they don't change the world, but if I can't do that much, then there isn't much point in being alive, it seems to me. So I choose to make some decisions according to my faith. And I happen to think economic systems can change. And I have power over me and maybe over some of that.
A comment on the word power that Judy had. And it's, I don't know if this is a good image or not, but it's one that I thought was, at least stuck with me. You mentioned that this week the Trident comes in. And now it's 550 feet of or more, I don't even know what the precise name is, a tremendous boat. And John Nelson was mentioned. And he's going out to meet that in a 17-foot fiberglass monstrosity, if you've seen it. It's unbelievably ugly. With himself and his mother and a couple other people. Two different powers are going to meet each other out there at Hood Canal. One of them with 12,000 A-bombs and several hundred people and tremendous things and the power of government behind it, and another 17-foot boat with something other kind of power. And the funny thing is that the Trident doesn't stand a chance.
That's hope.
Quote comes to my mind from one of my pastors out of the past who said, you just have to put your stubborn ounces on the side of the scale that you think is right.
And I think we'll end with that quote. And hopefully we've, I always say when I lead the forums at Holden that hopefully we've unsettled much. And that's their purpose. And I appreciate so much, especially those of you who are willing to state positions that are at least counter to mine, if not to what might be the thrust of the summer here, because we quite frankly can't operate without it, even though we'll argue and debate it and do everything to prevail. It's still very necessary for dialogue, and I quite frankly believe in this milieu it takes more courage to run those positions than to hold the ones I do. Other places, I think the reverse is true. So I want you to engage us on the teaching staff. Keep us honest. And so I appreciate your being here. And for those of you who wish, there will be a conference service here in about 5 minutes or less. So thank you. Have a good evening.